something I cannot describe. Foggy dark presence been choking my mind. The strings hanging down from heaven above, poking like pitchforks in a pure white dove. Through God's dark heaven go I, go I. Through God's dark heaven go I. Through God's dark heaven go I. Through God's dark heaven go I.
Sup, I'm Laura Kuzno, and welcome to Just a Music Podcast, where I, Laura Kuzno, tell you about some music history, how it relates to the world around us, and hopefully introduce you to some new tunes. This show is theoretically for everyone, but I will swear when it comes down to it, and sometimes we may need to talk about some sensitive topics, so your weeans might want to sit this one out. So hello, my friends, my foes, and fellow freaks. I'm here. I'm back. I'm so sorry it's taken so long. I feel like this is just going to be a running theme, me publishing an episode and then just fucking off for half a century. But here we are, and we have something new. So just some life updates from when you last heard from me. A lot's gone on in the Kuzno house, including people moving in and moving out and then moving back and then moving around and doing the hokey pokey and turning it all about. I applied for some, like, what, 430 some odd jobs? And that's not an exaggeration. Like, I think the final count was around like 445 or something like that. But so that took a lot of time, as you can imagine. I finally got a job, so I'm currently working for the Government of Canada, where what department I'm working from specifically, I'm not allowed to tell you. I'm not supposed to tell you. It's kind of in our contract, so I can't really disclose that. But I am working now. I don't like my job, but I mean, what can you do? That's living sometimes. You gotta make that fucking dollar stacks, dollar bills. So, needless to say, it's been a hell of a time. There's been some ups, there's been some downs, there's been a whole lot. But again, I'd like to apologize for not being here to talk to y'all, and frankly, I really miss it. So I'm gonna, I know I say this every time, but I'm gonna try to make this a more consistent thing now that I have sort of a set schedule going with going to work and coming home from work and, you know, doing all sorts of living in between all that. So hopefully we'll be getting you some more episodes somewhat soon. Going forward though, I will say that I'm not going to put a time frame on when y'all are going to get episodes, because as y'all have seen, that's just not something that's working for me. Essentially, you're just going to get them when you get them from now on, and that's just how it's going to go. Especially if me working a set schedule amount of hours during the week and whatnot, it's just not feasible for me to try to put something out that requires so much research and time, as I'm the only person working on this podcast any month. That being said, I've had some wonderful suggestions from a couple of y'all as to things that might be nice to incorporate, such as publishing episodes on YouTube in like a video essay format, or putting all the music that I show in episodes into one long playlist where people can publicly access that, and I think that would be really wonderful. I've also had the offer of a co-host to come on and sit here with me while I talk about music, so it's not just me laughing at my own jokes while rambling at you guys for untold amounts of time. So we'll see, but since I'm the only person working on this podcast, we'll see how any of those suggestions go, and maybe give me some feedback if you'd like to hear a co-host on this show or not. Like, I'm open to it. It doesn't have to be something we do. It doesn't have to be something we don't do. What would you guys like? Today's episode is something kind of special because in October of 2022, I got to do an interview with a friend of mine, Ninka, who is currently in school for journalism. The theme is one that I've covered on the show before in episode 3, which is Why Music is Political. She heard the episode and wanted to know more, so for one of her projects, she decided to take the time to talk to me about it. The version she submitted for class was only a few minutes long, as per the guidelines for the assignment, but we both thought it would be nice to release the full thing for y'all's enjoyment here today. So I've gone ahead and edited it a little bit. I have thrown in some musical excerpts so you guys get something fun to listen to, and we're just gonna play that for y'all today. So I hope y'all enjoy, and without further ado, here it goes.
So first of all, could you tell me your name, how it's spelled, and your position?
Yeah, so my name is Laura Kuzno. Kuzno spelled C-O-U-S-I-N-E-A-U. I'm currently unemployed, but I'm working on my podcast called Just a Music Podcast. I turned 27 earlier this week. My pronouns are they, them, and I live in a very small town in Ontario. Last year, I graduated from the University of Toronto Monk School of Global Affairs with a Master of Arts in History and Jewish Studies. My thesis concerned how listening to nostalgic music might be able to help assuage anxieties around the COVID-19 pandemic on an individual basis. I used klezmer and Ashkenaz, like it's an Ashkenaz Jewish music tradition, to demonstrate that point. In my undergrad, I largely focused my studies on music history and the music of minorities as much as I could manage, not actually being a student in the music department. So I did a major in history, a minor in music history, and then another minor in diaspora and transnational studies. And in my teen years, I was very convinced that I was going to go to school for opera performance. So I did opera, I think, from the time I started when I was 11 till I was like 18 or 19 years old. Yeah, the only reason I actually didn't end up going to school for that one was because of my brain's never been able to comprehend how to sight read sheet music very well, and I'm not very good at playing the piano. But otherwise, the voice was there. So yeah, that's who I am.
Awesome, thank you. So we're talking today about how music is political, which is one of your episodes of your podcast, Just Another Music Podcast. Could you tell me just like as an overview, how is music political?
Ooh, so music is political, and I tried to break it down in a couple ways that like somebody would be able to digest it. So I would say music's political in three major ways. So, and that is in aesthetics, content, and use. So as art is predicated off the idea of aesthetics, music also falls into this category. Any aesthetic thing is inherently political as it relies on societal pressure in its formation. So I'm going to be using mostly Western music examples when I talk about this, mostly because the history of Western music is something that I'm most familiar with and probably most of your listeners will be familiar with. Mm-hmm. So what I mean about Western art music, for people who don't know, is like thinking of like the classical era or the romantic era, the Baroque era and stuff like that, and the composers that who are associated with those periods. So when we talk about societal pressures that form these genres, we're talking not just technological advancement, because technology for a long time was very slow to advance, but we're also talking about the people who would sponsor the transformation of music during this time. So we would define those people as tastemakers now. In the traditional sense of Western music, this is typically to do with institutions that have money to support composers. So for a very long time, if you were a composer and you wrote hopefully good music, you wrote music that was favored by people in positions of power, they would support you. And if you didn't, then you had to write music that did. Otherwise, you would essentially just be a poor musician. That doesn't, like, it doesn't come as a stereotype from nowhere. So an example of this in classical music is that Gregorian music is called after the Pope at the time, Pope Gregory I, who is credited with creating the genre, even though he absolutely didn't. Like, that's, he didn't do that. That was something that was a natural formation over time. And then we get people like Johann Sebastian Bach, who was employed by the church, Mozart, who was employed by the Prince of Salzburg at the time, and Chopin, who was employed by a countess. So this is like something that you see very much as a continuation over time. Essentially, what constitutes proper and improper aesthetics is largely defined by its relation to how the upper class perceives it, and so it is political in that way. Mm-hmm. Like, why isn't folk music a thing that we listen to and that we hear a lot of in popular culture in the same way that we do classical music? And that's largely because folk musics were considered lowbrow by the upper classes for a very long time. It was considered vulgar, and so it's not well-preserved or promoted. It's a determining of aesthetics which helps keeps political lines and political power. So obviously in our day and age, like in the time that we live now, with different ideas of class and power, we look at different measures of aesthetic differently. So for example, in the podcast episode that you mentioned, Why Music is Political, I talk about Lana Del Rey and the sad girl aesthetic and how that aesthetic was meant to stand in direct opposition to the can-do, extreme sort of girl bossification and neoliberal ideas that have been driven into new waves of feminism, which also starts to run into two measures that I mentioned at the beginning of content and use as well. So the content of a song, its lyrics, music, videos, the album art, and basically anything that can be linked back to a song is the most obvious realm where it can first become political, because this is where the overt messages go. If the aesthetics are more of a subdued part of the politics of the situation, that, like, for example, you have to turn over a stone to find, the lyrics are the groundhog that's sunbathing on top of the stone. So this, of course, can take place in various shades of overt and covert. So, for example, and I'm going to give a few examples here. I tried to keep them as popular as possible so people would know what they were.
Okay.
But for a few examples, we have Fortunate Son by like Creedence Clearwater Revival, which was a really big anti-war song from our parents' generation largely. So like the opening stanzas, some folks are born to made the wave the flag, the red, white, and blue. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, they're pointing the cannon at you. Like, that's very overt. There's no way that you can look at that stanza and be like, oh, it's anti-political. It's just a song. You just listen to it. So that's a very anti-government song. It's not hard to figure that out. Or, like, This is America by Childish Gambino with allusions to mistreatment of, you know, black people in America.
Mm-hmm.
This is America. Don't got you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area.
My area.
I got the strap.
Hey.
I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm so dull like, yeah. We gon' blow like, yeah.
That's not a hard political statement to figure out. The national anthem is a type of propaganda which is inherently political. Like when Rammstein made the song video for their song Angst, it's a really, I think that album came out, what, 2021? Or early 2022. It's a very recent album. But when they made the music video, and the music video is basically depicts Trumpian era politics, so it shows a very unhinged politician strapped to like a standing gurney, ushered in by cheerleaders as he speaks to the people through their TVs as they slowly grow more anxious and violent to the point of self-destruction. That's a very easy political statement to parse.
Wenn die Kinder unerzogen, schon der Vater hat gedroht, der schwarze Mann, wird dich holen, wenn du nicht folgst meinem Gebot. Und das glauben wir bis heute, so in Angst sind Land und Leute. Etwas Schlimmes wird geschehen, das Böse kommt, wird nicht mehr gehen. Und die Furcht wächst in die Nacht, Tür und Tore sind bewacht, die Rücken nass, die Hände klamm, alle haben Angst vorm schwarzen Mann.
So even when it isn't as overt, the aesthetics that are brought into the lyrics can often be linked back to a political ideology. So, for example, when a band like Wednesday 13, which I know is not as popular, but when they write a song called Thank You, Satan, in the genre of metal, it's a statement of counterculture. And choosing to counter prevailing cultural norms is inherently political in the same way that someone releasing a song that's totally in sync with the popular culture is, just on different ends of the spectrum. So the last big realm of politics, I would say, is in music, is its use. So what do we use this music for? And youth can mean a lot of things. My own research and what I focused on in university had to do with the music of minorities, music of survival, how music can sometimes be used as a bridge between minority and majority populations. So, for example, music sung by Jewish people during the Holocaust in Yiddish is an example of a use which is political because it's positioning themselves as a cultural resistance to prevailing Nazi regime and Nazi ideas. But then there's also matters of platforming, which ties back to use, which, you know, like what music becomes famous, why does it become famous, why are some genres more mainstream than others, who's singing it and why are they singing it specifically. The language that somebody is using to sing a song can really denote a political stance, like especially in a place where they're singing a song and they're singing it not the dominant language that is being spoken in that country. What does that mean for that person? What is the type of stance that they want to give off? So when you listen to a Latino song, a song that's in Spanish in the U.S., what does that mean for you, and what does that mean for that singer to present that type of song? Who is represented as listeners to this genre, for example? Or why is metal typically dominated by white listeners and rap and hip-hop by people of color and largely Black and Latino? What does it mean to say, I like all music except for country and rap? That's a political statement because you're making a statement based off the aesthetics of the music. So these questions all have politically based answers, and some are much more complicated than others. So, and then there's use in terms of venue. So where is something being used? I took a particularly interesting class, I think in my third year of undergrad, called Heavy Music. And in it, I've always been a fan of rock and metal since I was a child. Like, since I was a very, like, it is alarming how young I was listening to heavy music. Like, I think my first concert was when I was 12 years old. And, yeah, so
Oh my God, I also had my first concert at 12 years old, like, that I chose to go to myself. But I went to...
But what did you go see?
I went to Mayday Parade and We the Kings.
It seemed like that sounds like a fun time. It sounds like a fun place with a very interesting and, like, very connected audience. I went to a symphonic metal concert.
Oh my God.
So I went to go see Nightwish and Sonata Arctica when I was 12 years old with my older sister. Amazing, she was 17 at the time and was very nonplussed about having her younger and much less cooler sibling there with her. But you know, that's just how siblings work. So
yeah.
That's just it. But like when we look at venues and music in venues, we look at things like, you know, when you walk into a public venue, a store, a park, or event, what type of music is playing and what does that music tell you? Who is welcomed in the space based on what the music is playing? What is the dress code for the sort of music that is playing? Like when you walk into a wedding or something and they're playing the wedding march and everything, like you expect to be wearing and be performing in a certain way that is more decorous, as opposed to if you're going to a punk concert and then you look like you crawled out of a sewer and you're ready to punch somebody. It's right. A very different type of situation.
Yeah.
So there was an instance I remember in the class that we were talking about, where music was being used in a city to denote the certain class of people that were allowed into different parts of a neighborhood. So there was an instance in the upper class neighborhoods where around basically the boundaries of it, they were playing what was considered more upper class music to kind of signal to lower class people that, hey, you aren't supposed to be here. And so that's a very overt use and venue of music that could be obviously described as political. When you're leaving people out on the basis of class, that's an inherently political statement. There's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
And even in, you know, North America, to bring it back to like North American stuff, there's a piece that John Oliver ran not super long ago in the US about how homelessness in the US is skyrocketing right now and the housing market and everything. But one of the examples that he used as like how bad of a situation it's getting is there was a town or city, I believe, in California where they were playing kids' songs really loud over public speakers to dissuade homeless people from sleeping there. So that's a political use of music. There's nothing you can do about that to make that unpolitical. So then, of course, there's use of music in specifically political venues, because, I mean, those venues technically that we're talking about aren't necessarily political, but there are political venues in which you can also use music that elevate it to a more political stance. So earlier I mentioned national anthems as a tool of propaganda, because, I mean, this is something, honestly, when I learned it, it kind of blew my mind. I never really made the connection before, but like, what is a national anthem other than bolstering your country's self-image? It's saying, this is what we are. This is our culture. We're great. We're great for these reasons. Maybe we have a great army. Maybe our women are beautiful, which is a surprisingly very recurrent theme in national anthems, especially for, you know, this day and age. But yes, the singing songs typically associated with a country like a national anthem is propaganda. Mm-hmm. Singing songs that go with a country's cultural and political stance or cultural and political ideology is propaganda. So one of the examples, like Yankee Doodle Dandy in the States, it might not be the national anthem, but it is highly associated with American culture, and thus the choice to sing it and how one sings it becomes political.
Yankee Doodle went to town a-riding on a pony. He stuck a feather in his hat and called it macaroni. Yankee Doodle, keep it up, Yankee Doodle Dandy. Find the music and the step and with the girls be handy.
In Canada, we have the song The Northwest Passage by Canadian folk singer Stan Rogers. And it again, not our national anthem, but I think I know more Canadians who know it than who don't. So songs like this that aren't necessarily, like, you don't think of them as necessarily political, can take on that sort of thing depending on venue. And then, of course, we have to move into venues that really just, I mean, most of us won't experience in our lifetimes, which, I mean, thank God. But in that class I was talking about, we also looked at music as a form of torture and terror. So this is something, unfortunately, that happens in the world that we live in. So one of the things we talked about was a playlist that we had gotten of songs that were used in torture in Guantanamo Bay. And that was it was really interesting to go through, because you could look at the different songs and think of them as like, why are they political? Why are they on here? Why are they being used for torture? And so you'd have things that are really discordant with the environment, like really sugary children's songs type situation. I'm not going to name any because it doesn't feel right to. But then you also have songs, like really heavy songs, like Let the Bodies Hit the Floor, like really intense metal songs that people who, you know, grew up in a regime in the Middle East that's kind of that has really shunned Western culture might not be aware of or might not be used to.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
And then things like, I think there was a Britney Spears song on there. Things like that that just really had like very different moral tones to what people might be used to. So things like that really influence how music is political in these venues. And that's basically the overview. Like, technically you could go any more into any one of these if you wanted to, but that's the bread and butter of it.
Thank you. I am curious, why do you think that some people are adverse to saying that music is political? That even when someone says, oh, I like every genre but country or rap, that they refuse to see that that statement as political?
I think a lot of it has to do with moral posturing. Like, coming from, like, as somebody who's talked to a lot of people about, like, if I had a choice of things I could do every day for the rest of my life, it would just be to talk to people about music, because honestly, it's so important. But from one of the things I picked up with talking to people, a lot of it is moral posturing. Like, they don't want to seem like bad people because they do X, Y, or Z. It's kind of like when you talk to somebody about systemic racism and they try to rebut you by being like, oh, I'm not racist, I like black people, I have black people as friends, you know, like things like that. Like, it's a posturing to try to save face. And I think people also don't want to put into leisure time something that makes them have to think more than they want to. Which, I mean, I don't want to say people are lazy, but I mean, if you're somebody who, like, and I, again, like, I don't blame people because I've been in this position. If you're working a job that is very hard, that is extremely strenuous, you don't want to come home at the end of the day and be like, okay, now I'm going to pick apart systemic racism in music and why I don't like this particular genre type situation. It's something that's kind of a mental privilege that we don't necessarily take into account when we're talking about teaching people about these things. And I wish we would.
That makes sense. Yeah, thank you. What was your own journey into discovering and thinking about music being political? Especially with, as you say, like, you've been in the position before where it's like, it's just hard to think about that stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, my journey with music starts really young. Like, music was always in the house growing up. When I was a kid, my mom's from Ohio, and given the time that she grew up, like, she listened to a lot of Motown and a lot of jazz and a lot of, like, disco and stuff like that, but also rock music, and my dad was very much into rock music when I was a kid. So that was always in the house. And then my older sister, because my older sister's about 5 years older than me. So when we were younger, she, like, if I was 10 years old, she was 15, she was listening to more mature stuff. So she listened to a lot of rap, rock, and metal and stuff like that. And I think my first eye-opening experience with listening to something where I was like, okay, this is inherently political, it was listening to a song called The Prison Song by System of a Down. System of a Down is kind of a new metal band that got really big in the early 2000s, especially with music and that related to the war in the Middle East and like Bush's whole aura, if you want to call it his whole shtick. So it was listening to that song where, like, during the song they give accurate pieces of data for the time of things in the prison system. So they have, like, if to quote some of the lyrics, nearly 2 million Americans are incarcerated in the prison system of the US. Like, the song was written during 2003, so I'm assuming it's more by now if trends have continued. And then also things like the percentage of Americans in the prison system has doubled since 1985.
To clamp down with your iron fist, drugs became conveniently available for all the kids. Following the Reich's movement to clamp down with your iron fist, drugs became conveniently available for all the kids.
Mother, my crack, my smack, my bitch, right here in Hollywood.
Nearly 2 million Americans are incarcerated in the prison system of the U.S.
They're trying to build a prison.
They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison.
For you and me to live in.
Another prison system. Another prison system. Another prison system.
For you and me.
Drag offenders fill your prisons, you don't even flinch. All our taxes paying for your wars against the new non-rich. Minor drag offenders fill your prisons, you don't even flinch. All our taxes paying for your wars against the new non-rich.
Mother, my crack, my smack, my bitch, right here in Hollywood.
The percentage of Americans in the prison system has doubled since 1985.
They're trying to build a prison.
They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison.
For you and me to live in.
Another prison system. Another prison system. Another prison system.
For you and me.
So, like, I was maybe 10 or 11 years old hearing this and being like, that's what? Something. That means something. Like, this, what is this about? Like, I want to know more about this. So, you know, from there, I was always kind of into music that was subversive, like what is intentionally being hidden from the public ethos and mythos in terms of popular music. And, you know, why is the music of a certain people being intentionally oppressed and why? And of course, like, that's a really dangerous path to go down to, because in one direction that can lead you to, like, good academic study and questioning of current social structures. But on the other hand, it can turn into, like, really conspiracy shit really fast, like QAnon, like, oh, you gotta question everything is bad type situation. I mean, not to be an asshole, but I'm gonna be an asshole. But yeah, so, like, as a teen, I got really into the music of the Roma in Eastern Europe. So people who, and this term is not accurate, but people who we know in North America as gypsies. Gypsies is a slur. We don't use that here. So them, and then the folk musics of people in Northern Europe, actually. So, like, the Sami people and their traditional folk techniques and their respective cultures and what music performance meant for them and how their music is evolving. So I also really quickly started getting into more ethnic folk musics of different places, just because, like, I've always been really interested in texture in terms of music and what we can do with, like, the elasticity of music, how it can change, how it can form over time, and what things you can shove together to make sound more interesting and why people are doing that. But then also things like really dark avant-garde stuff and minimalist stuff and post-genre stuff. So, and as that relates to harder genres that I was already into, and how that stuff was political in terms of how its aesthetic was different from what was going on in popular music.
That's interesting to hear your own journey into that. I don't think I've ever had, like, a specific moment where, like, I've thought, oh, music is political. But growing up, I was in orchestra in high school and middle school and elementary school the whole time. And I also continued playing after. But in like in my traditional like school, I would be in like symphony and we would play like Beethoven. We would play like Canon and D. We would play all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then outside of that, I did a lot of fiddling with a local mentor, Taylor Morris. He's really big with like, he runs this group called Gilbert Town Fiddlers. And he also had I don't know how to explain this on the spot, but he runs this like kind of like alternative string play group called String Play.
Ooh.
For kids in middle school and high school, where we learned about how to play fiddle music and how to play your own version of pop music, how to write your own music, stuff like that. So that's also, I think, I like looking back on that, that's also a political move, is to take you out of that traditional setting and expose you to like fiddle tunes.
Absolutely. Like what you were saying about like how in class you basically just focused on like Western art classics, that's actually something that originally got me into starting my podcast, because it was something that like as I talked to people who are taking like, and this is not to shit on UFT, like it's a great school, I went there for 7 years, like it's, you know, I love it. It's just when you're going into the music history programs at UFT, the first couple classes you take are specifically on Western art music and nothing else. And why is it that we always look at these artists and not folk artists, like you're saying, or like string artists specifically? Yeah. At one type of instrument, at fiddle. Yeah. Why are we calling it fiddle and not violin? Because really they're the same instrument. It's just the way that you play them is different, right? So yeah, like him choosing to have that moment with you guys is a very political statement. And it's a wonderful statement. I mean, it's diversity. And I mean, to be fair, like that's a bias. Like diversity in music, I think, is a very important thing. And diversity in the listening tradition is a very important thing. But it's a really interesting moment that he chose to have with you guys. And I mean, I would congratulate him for that.
He was awesome. He was the best. To look back and like see that in a different light even. All right. So
sounds rad.
Walk me. I know you mentioned a few songs before. Walk me briefly through an analysis of a song that is political for you.
So this was a really fun one because I mean, like my head is constantly swimming with songs all the time. Always when I wake up, when I go to, it's all music all the time. So I was like, should I pick something to, you know, that I could absolutely torture listeners with, or should I give them something a little bit more easy to digest? So I landed on this song. It's an Appalachian blues song. It's called Cheap Wine. It's from the album I Dreamed I Saw Paul Bunyan Last Night, and that's Dreamed, Not Dreamt. And it was published in 2003 by the artist Charlie Parr. So the song is really interesting. I really enjoy it because it's very relatable to me. It's about a man who lives in a small town and kind of the ennui and depression of living in a small town. And it's essentially him telling this story and like trying to reconcile with himself a series of events that happens where he's dealing with alcoholism. He's dealing with the same routine of waking up and going to bed every night while owning this store, like a liquor store where he sells cheap wine to people. And in the song, he talks about he accidentally committed a crime and he was able to blame it on somebody else. And that person ends up getting killed based on the crime that he committed. So like the themes of politicalness that we look at it. So small town ennui is a big one. If we're looking at it in terms of Appalachian blues, what does it mean to live in a small town in Appalachia? Why are the conditions like that in the town that you live in? And why aren't they getting better? Because for a lot of people in Appalachia right now, like living is very hard. I mean, it's always been really hard. If you want to look at any history of people living in Appalachia, it's a really hard place to live. And that's not accidental. That happens because of government policy. That happens because of capitalism. That happens because of all sorts of things. So an unreliable narrator that has depression and alcoholism, like drug use is unfortunately a very big problem in Appalachia. Like they have one of the highest rates, I think, in West Virginia of opiate use of any of the 50 states. And that's, again, that's a political problem. Like, why is this happening? Why is depression such a big thing? Why isn't there help for people? Why isn't there money to help people? So covering up a murder is obviously a very political thing. Like, why are you choosing to cover it up? What does it mean for you? Why do these, like, what is the political punishment for what is happening to you at the moment? And his position as a businessman in the song really has a lot to do with that. So how do we see people in business politically versus people? He mentions the kid who ends up getting killed for his crime. Like he drank a lot. There really wasn't anything going for him. He didn't have any property. He didn't have a job or anything. So how does his political being as a human being contrasts with that of the narrator. And why would people in a small town maybe want to believe somebody who has a business who's trying to keep the economy going versus a kid that really has nothing going for him? So, and then you get into more like overt kind of statements of like the first, it's the refrain in the song, but it's also, I think, the first stanza in the song. So you see all the old ladies coming in to buy the cheap wine, and they ain't no better off than all the bums coming in to buy the cheap wine. Like, we're all sort of in this, and we're making different stratifications. Yeah. Based off of the society where there's really nothing left to stratify. Like, we're all really in the shit together, to put it in a very unfortunate term. So looking at the different political reasons of like why we're in this, why do we try to keep making these stratifications? Mm-hmm. Why can't we just look inward at ourselves and be like, hey, like, we need to come together to do something about this? And why does it just keep getting worse?
See all these old ladies coming in here to buy the cheap wine. They ain't no better law, they ain't no better than all these bums coming in here to buy the cheap wine. I never meant to do anything wrong or do any harm, Lord, but I framed that kid. He wasn't so bright. He was drunk. He was drunk all the time. Anyway, they killed him, not me. I've got a business here to run. I've got property. He had nothing. Lord, ain't no better. They ain't no better than all these poor bums coming in here to buy the cheap wine. But I'm better than all this. That crazy derelict, you can go to hell. I'm better than this. I make my own way. Sometimes I'll open the store an hour before daybreak. Put all the labels facing out. I'm so tired of all the labels. Why don't they just say it is all cheap wine?
So something as very simple, a story about a guy getting killed is not like, and I mean, like, for people who don't listen to the stories like music with darker tones, ballads with darker tones, it might not be as normal, but like in folk tradition, songs like this are very common. Very, very common. And they do something that I think is very important to look for in music, which is to tell the political sort of forecast of what's going on at the time.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
How does or should this understanding of music as political change the listener's relationship to music?
So I had a really hard time with this. I really wrestled with talking about this question because, like, again, this comes from the bias of somebody who is incredibly passionate about music and would really love for everybody else to be as passionate about music as I am. But I understand that that's not the case for a lot of people. So, but I think a lot of it comes down to a personal moral philosophy. So I appreciate if people thought more critically in regards to to their media consumption and like how they choose to move throughout the world. Like, absolutely. That's no question. I would love for people to do that. All art has an impact on how we view the world and how the world is viewed. So I think understanding and accepting that, whether or not we want to, it's very, very important. Like, there's such a dearth of education on the importance of art and how to understand it. I don't know about you, but I come from a relatively economically unwell area of Ontario. So in third grade, we had quote unquote music class where we were kind of taught how to play a plastic recorder that you got from the dollar store. It seems like a relatively common experience in North America.
Yeah, we had that as well. Although I will caveat that by saying that the area that I grew up in is pretty economically well off. But we still had the same, like, they handed out the recorders. You paid, like, $5 for it or something.
Yeah, yeah, it was, like, some, like, abysmally small amount to, like, learn how to play the recorder, right? I mean, like, nobody's becoming a classical performer off of that just by itself. So, like, we had that. And, I mean, it's good to know that it's something that's even happening in, like, more affluent neighborhoods because, I mean, like, I know friends who also, like, who had, when I got to university, I got to know people who came from more affluent families, thank God, and just learn how things are different in different parts of society. And of course they had like, oh, I went to a private school or I got to learn how to play oboe as a kid. And I was like, man, I wish I would have had that experience. Ain't that just the way? So we had that. And then I think in grade eight, we had a music class. Like I think one day of 1 week of 1 year, we had a music class. It was mostly on, it was the teacher talking about a rock opera. I think it was Tommy by The Who, and that was it. Like that was music class. It was like, ooh, look at this piece of music, wonderful, excellent. Like nothing about theory, nothing about history, nothing about, you know, impact or anything, just that. So like we could take music classes in high school. So when I got to high school, I took as many music classes as I could. I actually ended up staying a partial year after I graduated in grade 12, just so I could take a keyboard class, which was being taught by our guitar teacher that year. And thank God I did, because that's really the only experience I have with playing piano. But they weren't really regarded as necessary. Like music classes were not something you were required, like art classes in general were not something you were required to take. In my high school, it was mostly math, science, English, and English, I think, was the only course that you had to take all the way through. And math and science, I believe, you didn't have to take them past grade 11, I don't think. So, but I mean, I was lucky in high school in that my parents, they scraped together money to allow me to have private vocal lessons and actually music theory lessons too. But because we were working class, like that meant like I went on vacation once as a child, and that was like 2 days in Pittsburgh when we went to go to Kennywood, and then we went to like Gettysburg as like a day trip because my mom loves American history. Like we didn't do things. My mom never bought herself new clothes. We never had new vehicles. We never, like, if things were broken in our house, they just didn't get fixed, because between getting something like your couch fixed or getting the fridge fixed and, you know, having your child have a bit of music education, it was more important to them that I have that experience than putting it into the well-being of our house. So like I was really lucky in that way. A lot of people's families can't do that or unable to do that for, you know, whatever reason. Like I'm not saying that people whose parents don't do that are assholes. Like obviously there are so many circumstances where people just can't afford to do something like that. But if you don't have that drive to take classes in high school like that, or don't have the opportunity to do private lessons, like your music education in public education in North America is trash. It is abysmal. There is nothing. It is so sad. And like I know I'm not the first person to say that, and I won't be the last, but it is a joke. And I think that in itself, the choice to defund art programs is a political choice. Like I'm not saying that STEM education like isn't important. Of course it is. Like we live in a very highly technical dependent world. Like we need people to be in those professions to be able to keep our world functional. But without proper understanding of art and culture and keeping our minds open to experiences of the world around us, what are we living for? You know, like, what do you get up for in the morning if not to be able to experience things and experience life? So people come home at the end of the day from their job. What do they want to do? They want to listen to music. They want to watch TV. They want to see a movie. They want to play a video game. Like, these are all things that are forms of art. We don't necessarily think of them as art because we haven't been taught to think of them as art. But, like, my younger sister just graduated with a degree in animation. Animation is an art. She's gotten employed within 2 months because the animation business is booming right now because of the pandemic. Like she's in a very lucky position where she, like, art is something that she can do and that is very important in society right now in that sort of sense. But when, like, it's something that we do all the time. Like when you've been through a really bad breakup and you're heartbroken and you don't know what to do with yourself, like you don't throw yourself into doing differential equations. You throw yourself into participating in art. You read, you write, you listen to music, you cry, you watch a sad movie. Like you do all these things that are available to you because artists do them and because people took the time to learn about them and do them for a living. So like when you meet a person from a culture that's different than yours and you don't have a language in common, what do you share with that person? You usually share music with them or you share food with them, which is an edible form of, you know, self-expression that I would consider as art. Like, it's something that it's very universal for all of us. So I would argue when you take away arts education, you create a population of people who lose the ability to understand one another, to effectively communicate their feelings, and it stunts, like, understanding across generational, racial, and ethnic divides in people. So it's a really sad state of affairs. Like, a population devoid of meaningful conversations as it pertains to art and what is going on around them really just creates a society that's based on technological advancements, how much money they can rake in, and how to keep doing that continuously. There's a wonderful lyric, actually, because I've always been fond of using music as a way to describe feelings and ideas more than my own words. Because really, if you want to look at the history of music in a very archaic sense, before we had words, we had sounds and rhythms, and that's how we communicated with one another. And I think there is a way to do that today in the way that people use poetry, but there's a very wonderful lyric from a Nightwish song called The Song of Myself. The back half of that song is just spoken word poetry, which is fantastic. But the lyric is something like, paper is dead without words, ink idle without a poem, all the world dead without without stories, without love and disarming beauty. And that's something that's really touched me, of like, what are we without art? So to go back to your question, what I prefer if people looked at themselves and looked at the art that they're consuming or participating in and think about how it affects their own personal politics, the politics around them, and what it's saying to them and other people, I would absolutely. There's no question about it. On the other hand, I understand that music is, by its own definition, largely a leisure activity. Like, it's, you know, it's something that people, like, there's a very, very, very small portion of the population who are musicians for a living. Vanishingly small. And I mean, like, thank God now we have technologies that allow people to be musicians from their own homes. That's a great space that we're being able to fill. But it's just, it's a vanishingly small population. And I'm not going to get on people's asses about what they do in their spare time. Like, I'm very much a person who believes if in your spare time you're going to do what you're going to do, as long as you aren't physically or mentally hurting somebody, I'm okay with that. But would I prefer if people were more critical about it? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
If someone wants to be more critical about the music they listen to, what can they look out for to deepen that understanding?
So I think it's less about what people can look for and instead more of the questions that people can ask themselves. Ask questions before you listen to something, during listening to something, and after listening to something, in the same way that you might a book. You know, if you're looking at a book for class, you might engage in the same process. So you can choose not to question anything all the time, always. And that's, I mean, that's your choice. Go blissfully through life. Amen. Namaste. Thank God. But I would suggest that if people want to understand politics and music better, to look into the history regarding genres. Like, I'm kind of biased on that one again, because, like, that's what I do in my podcast, is look at the history of genres. But also, you know, I was a history student, so the history of things is very important. But, you know, like, look into things also in terms of, like, when was this song published and what was going on during the time that that song was published? What do these lyrics mean, and what is behind the genre that you're currently listening to? Who's performing it, and what does that mean? So, like, I know the big buzzword right now in terms of, like, academic people on social media is critical thinking. And I know, like, people are like, okay, we're good, critical thinking. Like, what are we doing? Like, we gotta think more critically about things. But, like, a lot of people, I don't think, know what that means. It's kind of like, it's like synergy. It's like, ah, we gotta have synergy. Like, it's just things that are thrown around out there that people just know, right? So when you take a senior level course in university, and I know that's not everybody's experience, but it's my experience, so I'm gonna talk about it. So when you take one of those senior courses in university in humanities, it's basically just exercises in critical thinking, and as it relates to whatever subject that you're talking about that week. So, like, I mean, some of my senior courses were music and politics, very apropos of our podcast, or looking at music and genocide was a class I took a couple times because there was undergrad and grad versions of that class, so things like that. But there's actually kind of a method to critical thinking and how you can go about it in order to elicit, I guess, more learning from whatever it is that you're looking at. There's actually a really helpful graph on critical thinking that the National Geographic published somewhat recently, and, like, how to exercise critical thinking, which I could send you if you want. And you could link it under the thing if you really want. So, yeah, it breaks down things. Like, the main part about critical thinking is basically doing what you learned how to do when you were a child and reading books in, like, grade two. But, like, the who, what, where, when, why, how, and how to apply them. So, like, applying them to music for who, like, who is playing the music, who is listening to the music, who benefits from publishing this music. And then what does this music make you feel? What is this music trying to convey to you? What are its strengths and weaknesses? What is the important and not important about it? What instruments are being used and why? Where is a concert being performed? Where is the genre most prevalent? Where is the song being recorded? Where was the song published or hosted? Because different songs can be published on different media now. Like, if something was published specifically on Spotify, that's one thing. If it's published on SoundCloud, that's another thing. Like, they mean wildly different things in terms of music. But was it published? Was it just a song some guy played in his backyard? That's that's a thing that you could look at. Where is the band from? Where are the instruments from in terms of their origin, but also in terms of brand, but also in terms of maybe where they're standing on the stage while playing those instruments? When was the song or band or genre popular? When was the type of music invented? What do you hear? Like, when do you hear this type of music? Do you only hear it in, like, public spaces? Do you hear it at home? Is it something that people play for other people? Is it something that people play for themselves? Why is this type of music important?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they decide to use these instruments? Why did they decide to write the lyrics? Like, different things, like any type of who, what, where, when, why that you can apply to different parts in music is always going to be something that's going to lead you to a more political answer. And I think the biggest one in that set is how. How is always, it's because how is the connections? It's where you make the connection. So how do these things relate to politics? How do they relate to one another? How does this piece change or influence my understanding of a particular phenomenon? And how am I complicit or challenging the narrative set out by this music? How is my participation affecting others? And how has this music been used traditionally? Like, those are all questions that potentially have political answers. So critical thinking is something that you just apply. I mean, it's going to take a time if you aren't used to it, if you aren't used to sitting there and constantly asking yourself questions. Like, it's a little tiring. You could start out small, but yeah, it's something that, I mean, anybody can do. You got a brain, you can do it.
Is there anything else that you want to share with me? Anything you think I missed?
I don't think so. I mean, if you want to listen to my podcast, that's on Spotify. That's Just a Music Podcast by Laura Cousineau, once again. Other than that, I would like to wish people the best time with listening to music. If you are not used to listening to a certain genre, maybe try opening up and looking at something different. If you only want to listen to music within one specific genre for the rest of your life, I hope you have a grand time. But either way, I hope music takes on a very important part in your life and that it's always there for you, even when anything else can't be.
Well, thank you so much for spending this time with me. I really enjoyed talking to you about this.
Yeah, all the more power to you, man. I hope this goes well and hope to talk to you soon.
So with that, that's all for Just a Music Podcast this week. I hope you've heard something new. I hope you heard something that you like. If you haven't, there's always next time where I've got something a little secret and a little special I'm working on for y'all that I've been procrastinating on for way too long because I don't want to talk about Eminem because I don't like talking about Eminem because I'm not a big fan of Eminem. But, you know, we're going to get there, so that's fine. In the meantime, though, if one of y'all would like to suggest a topic, I would love nothing more than to answer your musical questions or talk about topics that interest you guys in music. The topic that we have coming up next time actually was a fan suggestion. So thank you for that, Jordan, and hopefully I'll be able to do your suggestion any sort of justice. But in the meantime, if y'all have anything else you'd like to talk to me about, feel free to drop me a line at justamusicpodcast@gmail.com.